Assalamualaikum, salam sejahtera. Saya Nazri Kahar. WEF 2019 World Economic Forum yang sedang berlangsung di Davos, Switzerland yang sudah memasuki hari kedua sebenarnya. Satu conversation ataupun temubual yang ditunggu-tunggu oleh masyarakat dunia iaitu antara His Royal Highness the Duke of Cambridge iaitu Prince William yang akan menemubual seorang tokoh alam sekitar yang tidak asing lagi, terutamanya dalam melihat bagaimana kelangsungan dunia berhadapan dengan peredaran ataupun perubahan cuaca atau dipanggil dengan climate change, iaitu Sir David Attenborough. Jadi sebelum kita ke Davos bila-bila masa sahaja dan sekarang untuk mendengar temubual ini, tetapi rakan saya iaitu Kamarul Bahrain Harun, Timbalan Ketua Pengarang Esrawani dan juga Editor Esrawani Ashraf Ismail sudah bersedia di sana dengan bingkisan apa yang akan diperkatakan oleh Sir David Attenborough dan juga apa yang diperjuangkan oleh beliau kerana beliau salah seorang penerima anugerah kristal yang dianugerahkan oleh World Economic Forum untuk 2019 ini. Jadi mungkin rakan saya Kamarul Bahrain Harun dan juga Ashraf Ismail sudah bersedia di Davos. Mungkin Cik Kam, apa yang kita perlu ketahui dengan tokoh naturalist dan juga environmentalist ini, Sir David Attenborough?
Terima kasih Haji. Haji untunglah berada di studio yang biasanya sejuk kalau kita di Kuala Lumpur, tapi di sini lebih sejuk je. Semalam sampai ke minus 15 ataupun tolak 15. 15 darjah di bawah tahap beku dan saya sekarang berada di satu persekitaran yang cukup cantik. Haji Nazri, satu hari datanglah ke sini. Davos Clusters. Ini adalah kluster dua pekan kecil pegunungan Alps yang berdekatan satu sama lain. Soalnya tentunya Haji bertanyakan tentang Sir David Attenborough dan juga bakal waris tu kepada takhta Britain ataupun England dalam kes ini. Saya ingin terus saja, Sir David Attenborough ni hanya satu tahun lebih kurang muda daripada Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad. Beliau sama tua dengan Queen. Jadi isu yang beliau bawakan cukup mendapat perhatian kerana kredibiliti yang dibina sekian lama sebagai wartawan macam kita, Haji. Tapi dia wartawan dokumentari yang begitu dalam sekali pemerhatian dan garapan. Dan ramai, bukan saja putera raja yang membesar ketika mereka bersekolah dan sebagainya, melihat pada dokumentari tentang alam sekitar yang beliau buat. Dan termasuklah tentang Borneo, beliau menyebut ini dalam temubual satu siri rancangan bual bicara di BBC pada bulan Disember. Beliau risau jika kita tidak melakukan sesuatu, mungkin great-great-granddaughters or grandson yang beliau akan ada keturunan dan seterusnya tidak akan dapat melihat keindahan yang seperti beliau pernah paparkan walaupun di Borneo. Dan beliau berkata sendiri perkara itu. Jadi Malaysia pun pernah diliputi dan sekarang sebagai orang yang begitu memperjuangkan alam dan perkara yang semula jadi, sebab itu beliau juga dipanggil sebagai naturalist. Kita akan mendengar apa yang beliau sampaikan. Yang penting, seperti ketika mendapat anugerah kristal, kita masih ada harapan walaupun kita ada masa 12 tahun mengikut panel IPCC untuk mengekalkan perubahan suhu pada 1.5 darjah Celsius sahaja, kerana manusia kini mempunyai teknologi dan keupayaan lebih tinggi dalam mana-mana era. Tetapi era halusin di mana alam semula jadi itu stabil sudah berlalu. Beliau berkata hanya dalam satu generasi manusia sudah menukar era itu kepada era yang semakin tidak menentu.
Ya, Sir David Attenborough ini seorang tokoh yang dihormati di Britain dan beliau sering dijemput oleh Queen untuk ke istana dan berbicara tentang isu-isu alam sekitar kerana kerjaya beliau seorang editor di BBC dan banyak sekali menerbitkan dokumentari yang bertaraf dunia seperti The Blue Planet dan juga The Dynasties. Dan pastinya dalam ucapan menerima anugerah kristal WEF 2019, isu yang dibawa oleh Sir David berkaitan dengan perubahan cuaca, mungkin apa pendidikan yang diberi penekanan Cik Kam dalam ucapan beliau tentang climate change ini?
Ya Haji, penting juga untuk kita ketahui ya, kenapa Davos membincangkan perkara seperti perubahan iklim? Kerana kegagalan yang berlaku dalam banyak pertemuan dan organisasi sedunia serantau yang lain agak kurang berlaku di sini. Ini kerana pertemuan yang berlaku di Davos ini begitu pelbagai dan majmuk. Daripada pejuang yang paling hebat yang pernah rantaikan diri mereka kepada pokok dan sebagainya, sampailah kepada mereka yang menjadi ketua pegawai eksekutif syarikat terbesar, antara terbesar di dunia, yang banyak mempengaruhi susut dan selok belok alam sekitar semula jadi di seluruh dunia, termasuklah di Arktik dan Antartika. Jadi di sini pertemuannya berlangsung, apa yang berlaku dalam revolusi perindustrian keempat, definisi itu adalah titik-titik peradaban manusia, sama ada teknologi, sosial, ekonomi dan sebagainya, budaya, semuanya kini bercantum dengan jaringan yang diupayakan oleh teknologi. Apa yang berlaku di Davos, di World Economic Forum atau WEF ini, jaringan itu turut berlaku dalam konteks pemikiran, hati, perasaan dan juga inisiatif manusiawi. Inilah yang paling penting. Sebab itu walaupun ada sesi bersama Putra Raja dan Sir David Attenborough, tetapi ada juga pejuang-pejuang NGO-NGO dan syarikat korporat. Malah kepada rakan-rakan saya seperti Ashwat yang nanti berada tempat lain, beliau tempat beliau kurang sikit sejuk, pelik ya orang tua berada tempat paling sejuk, tapi tak apa. Mereka yang hisap rokok pun di sini, PMI, syarikat pengeluar tembakau rokok terkemuka, meminta supaya janganlah lagi kita bergaduh pada anti rokok. Mari kita berbincang bagaimana kita boleh menyelesaikan masalah ini. Itulah yang orang tidak nampak jika tidak hadir sendiri dalam kesejukan di Davos, memperkatakan tentang perubahan peradaban manusia menuju ke depan.
Ya, saya tak sabar nak dengar temubual Putra William dan juga Sir David Attenborough, kerana dua tokoh ini ada peranan masing-masing. Misalnya Putra William begitu giat dengan yayasan berkaitan dengan anti pemerdagangan hidupan liar, terutamanya pemerdagangan gading gajah, dan beliau begitu serius dalam kempen itu. Dan pastinya beliau juga menganggap Sir David Attenborough sebagai national treasure kepada Britain ataupun United Kingdom, dan pastinya satu temubual yang menarik yang akan kita lihat sebentar saja lagi. Tetapi mungkin Cam, apa yang ditemubual oleh rakan kita Ashraf Ismail di Davos juga?
Haji, ada banyak lagi perkara. Sebab itulah saya bersama Ashwat, dua orang ni pun tidak tercakup jangkauan kami. Banyak perkara yang sedang berlaku, dan nanti Ashwat akan ceritakan pertemuan eksklusif beliau bersama dua pengerusi bersama. Saya rasa ada 6 pengerusi bersama untuk WEF 2019, dan kali ini mereka bukanlah, kalau pemain bola sepak tu bukanlah Cristiano Ronaldo, tetapi mereka bintang-bintang yang kurang dikenali sejagat tetapi cukup berkesan di mana mereka berada dan aktiviti yang mereka lakukan. Dua pengerusi bersama itu, salah seorang daripadanya cuba melakukan perkara yang sukar untuk kita lakukan di Malaysia, iaitu menyelesaikan masalah sampah. Mereka menyelesaikannya dengan melakukan aktiviti supaya sampah tidak banyak dikeluarkan oleh sesuatu komuniti ataupun kampung itu. Dan ini dilakukan di peringkat akar umbi. Itu yang begitu-begitu unik tentang perkara ini. Dan seorang lagi pula adalah seorang yang diambil terus. Kalau kata Ashwat lah, Ashwat kan bahasa dia macam megong ataupun lostak bagat batal sikit. Dia kata macam diambil terus daripada kamp pelarian, diletakkan di sini, betul, hantar balik ke kamp pelarian. Taklah seteruk itu, tetapi itulah gambarannya daripada transisi yang terpaksa dihadapi oleh pengerusi bersama ini yang muda ini, seorang refugee ataupun pelarian. Eloklah Haji terus untuk kembali ke sana dan punya mungkin terus bersama dengan Ashwat.
Ya, terima kasih Cam di Clusters Davos, dan bila-bila masa saja dari sekarang kita masih menanti untuk temubual Putra William dan juga Sir David Attenborough. Tetapi terus bersama kami di Agenda Awal ini. Kita rehat dahulu, jumpa lagi selepas ini. Saya sempat membuat sedikit penyelidikan tentang Sir David Attenborough, satu profil yang begitu menakjubkan dan pastinya temubual yang kita akan dengar sebentar saja lagi, suatu yang ingin kita dengar, apatah lagi dalam dunia yang begitu melihat isu alam sekitar, suatu yang begitu penting, isu perubahan cuaca, isu berkaitan dengan pencemaran alam sekitar. Dan antara yang menjadi daya tarikan Davos 2018 pada tahun lalu iaitu kempen tentang The Blue Planet, iaitu kempen untuk memastikan ocean ataupun lautan kita bebas daripada plastik, dan ia menjadi satu fenomena di seluruh dunia mengambil ataupun buy in this idea, dan akhirnya kita akan melihat bagaimana masyarakat dunia sedikit sebanyak ingin mengelakkan penggunaan plastik dalam kehidupan seharian kita dengan kempen The Blue Planet ini. Dan pastinya ini juga yang dimahukan oleh Pengerusi Bersama yang sempat ditemubual oleh rakan saya Ashraf Ismail. Mungkin ada perinciannya.
Baik, Haji Nazri. Baik, walaupun tiada pemimpin-pemimpin utama yang kontroversi seperti yang mencerminkan apa yang berlaku ketika ini dalam landscape geoekonomi dunia seperti trade war, perang perdagangan antara Amerika Syarikat dan China, tiadanya Presiden Xi Jinping, tiadanya Presiden Donald Trump, itu tidak bermakna mereka tidak boleh berbincang mengenai penyelesaiannya. Kerana pada satu sisi, apa yang berlaku ketika ini ialah masyarakat secara umumnya, ia bukan lagi mengenai cerita elit ataupun golongan-golongan kaya semata-mata. Tetapi mereka berkumpul di Davos, kita melihat kepada sisi di mana refleksi kemahuan dan aspirasi masyarakat ketika ini lebih melihat kepada kepemimpinan yang ada, bukan sahaja dalam sektor kerajaan dan politik, tetapi tokoh-tokoh korporat, ahli-ahli perniagaan, startup, mereka yang muda telah menunjukkan leadership dan pendapat serta idea mereka itu yang lebih bernilai untuk diimplementasikan. Itulah mengenai globalisasi 4.0, Haji Nazri. Kerana kita umum tahu, ia bukan sahaja mengenai teknologi dan kemajuan yang arus yang dibawa bersama dengannya. Tetapi apakah nilai untuk kemanusiaan itu? Itu yang ditekankan. Dan antara perkara menarik seperti jika kita perlihatkan kepada idea-idea baru, selama ini kita memberi penekanan, kata kita kena pakai kereta elektrik lah, ini akan membantu untuk mengurangkan kebergantungan kita kepada minyak contohnya. Tetapi jika diperhatikan, daripada berjuta tong minyak sehari yang dipakai seluruh dunia penggunaannya, ia sebenarnya hanya mengurangkan 50 ribu tong sehari. Itu mengenai kereta elektrik. Dan akhirnya perbincangan menjurus ke arah bagaimana ini dapat diatasi, terutamanya kebergantungan kita kepada sumber tenaga yang lama, kepada tenaga yang boleh diperbaharui menjelang 2030. Harus diingat, sasarannya adalah sekitar 80 hingga 90% menjelang 2030, Haji Nazri. Ketika ini, kereta elektrik hanya digunakan seluruh dunia ini hanyalah menggunakan 50 ribu tong minyak sehari sahaja, Haji Nazri. Itu yang perlu dicari dan diterokai solusinya.
Ya, Ashraf, kita ingin terus mendengar bingkisan dari Davos, Clusters Davos. Pemikir-pemikir memberikan impak ataupun memberikan tafsiran mereka tentang isu-isu dunia pada ketika ini, apatah lagi memasuki era 2019. Dan pastinya Ashraf Ismail dan juga Kamarul Barin Harun akan terus memberikan perinciannya dari hari ke hari, dan juga di dalam Buletin Awal ini dan juga program-program di Astro Awal ini. Dan kita beri tumpuan kepada conversation with Sir David Attenborough dan juga His Royal Highness Putra William.
Into a meadow in England, and he turned over a stone and he saw a slug, and he said, "Look, a slug! What a treasure!" And of course, he's right. I mean, what are those two things sticking out at the front? What are they for? How does it move? What does it feed on? Astonishment. And that goes on and on and on. Of course, the time comes when other things come into it. And in this day and age, who's not to wonder at the miracles of the electronic age that he sees? But that should be fitted in alongside. If you lose that first wonder, you've lost one of the most greatest sources of delight and pleasure and beauty in the whole of the universe, in the whole of the wide world. And so caring for that brings joy and enlightenment, which is irreplaceable. That is one of the great pleasures of life. And if you lose sight of that, you've lost a great source of joy.
And do you feel, David, that the advances in technology particularly have played a key role in wildlife filmmaking?
Yes, I mean, you asked us what it was like 50, 60 years ago. The amazing thing was 50, 60 years ago, nobody had, or very few people in Britain, or in Europe indeed, had actually seen a pangolin or an armadillo. So it didn't matter how badly or amateurishly you were, if you showed a shot of an armadillo, people were looking at television. They didn't look at it in a particular critical way, they just saw an armadillo and thought, my goodness, what on earth is that? So making natural history films in those days was comparatively easy, you know, because you just show the animals and people were astounded. They're a bit more sophisticated now. But the facilities we now have are unbelievable. We can go everywhere. We can go to the bottom of the sea. We can go into space. We can use drones, we can use helicopters, we can use macro worlds, we can speed things up, we can slow things down, we can film in the darkness. So the natural world has never been exposed to this degree before. And there are shots in this series of films that we are just launching today, and indeed many of natural history films, which 20 years ago, nobody could have even imagined.
And do you think it's the real detail that the new technology can bring out? Do you think that is something that really captures people's imagination, that they can see into areas of life and nature they've never seen before? And you yourself have said many times, you're seeing things for the first time on some of those films.
Yes. Yes, and the wonderful thing from the point of view of a television program maker is that this is international. You don't need language. It goes all around the world. People all around the world get the same joy, the same wonder, the same splendor, the same gasp of excitement just by looking at these things. And as long as the narrator figure doesn't get between you and the animals too often, you're okay.
There's been a few of those instances, David. For many years, though, as a TV presenter at least, you held back a bit from speaking quite publicly about environmental issues. Was there a reason you decided to do that?
Well, when I started 60 years ago, in the mid-50s, and to be truthful, I don't think there was anybody in the mid-50s who thought that there was a danger that we might annihilate part of the natural world. There were animals that were in danger, that's true. And there were animals that we could see, if we didn't do something, they were going to become extinct. And the notion that human beings might exterminate a whole species was a slightly, I wouldn't say alarming one, you just hadn't thought about it. And if it did occur, as it did with the Arabian oryx, for example, it seemed the exception. Now, of course, we are only too well aware that the whole of the natural world is at our disposal, as it were, that we can do things accidentally that exterminate a whole area of the natural world and the species that live within it.
Of course. So is there sort of one particular reason or several reasons why you decided to change your mind about this and have started to make some more bold conservation films?
Yes, and of course, if you were a sensitive naturalist, you would recognize that there were areas, we began to recognize that there were areas in which this animal may have disappeared or that may have disappeared. But the notion that humanity might exterminate a whole community of animals was quite foreign. I don't think many people thought that. And of course, the naturalists were the exception in a way. They were people with their eyes open, their sensitive tentacles prepared to see what was happening around them. But you know, now there are more people living in towns and conurbations than they're living in the wild. So it means that the majority of the human race are out of touch to some degree with the richness of the natural world. And so what they see on television is new to them, but at the same time, people who watch the natural world on television get a vision of the world that no human beings ever had 100 years ago. 100 years ago, people didn't know anything about the world. They knew about their immediate circumstances, and of course they read books and so on. But now television can take them to the bottom of the sea, and they can take them high in the sky, and they can take them into the Arctic and the coldest regions and on the top of the Himalayas, everywhere, and you can see the most remote things.
And David, recently you were in Poland. You spoke very powerfully at the UN climate change conference there. Tell everyone here, how urgent is that crisis now?
It's difficult to overstate it. We are now so numerous, so powerful, so all-pervasive, the mechanisms that we have for destruction are so wholesale and so frightening that we can actually just exterminate whole ecosystems without even noticing it. We have now to be really aware of the dangers of what we're doing. And we already know that, of course, the plastic problem in the seas is wreaking appalling damage upon marine life, the extent of which we don't yet fully know.
And why do you think the sort of the world leaders and those in key positions of leadership, why do you think they've taken so long and there've been quite a few faltering steps to act on environmental challenges?
Because the connection between the natural world and the urban world, the society of human society, has always, since the Industrial Revolution, has been remote and widening. And we didn't realize the effects of what we were doing out there. But now we are seeing that almost everything we do has its echoes and has its duplications and implications across the natural world, so that we have now to really to care for what we do, because we can exterminate things without even knowing.
And as you've alluded to in some of your films, David, there are still great sources of medicinal products and all sorts of things out there that we still don't know about, and there are still many species that we don't know about. Some that we will never know about because they maybe disappeared from the planet.
That is so, and it may seem that when we say, oh, well, this or that bird or that mammal is rare and ought to be protected, people say, well, yes, is that just the naturalist saying it's a luxury or a pleasure, or is it really important? Are you really sure? The problem about extermination of species is that the natural world, of which we are a part, is incredibly complex. It has connections all over the place. And you damage one, and you can never tell where the damage is going to end up because of all those broken connections. And if you break all of them, then suddenly the whole fabric collapses and you get eco-disaster. I mean, to give a particular example, in the early 19th, 20th century, the sea otter on the Pacific had the most luxurious fur that human beings had ever come across. So, of course, you hunt sea otters. And then suddenly you began to realize that actually sea otters were getting rarer and rarer, and they were on the verge of extinction. At the same time, but a second group of people saw that the seas around the Pacific Ocean, up on the Pacific Northwest, of the Pacific Ocean, the food fish were getting scarcer. And it didn't seem there was any connection between the two. But actually, sea otters prey upon sea urchins. Sea urchins actually live on the floor of the sea, and they eat small sea algae, fucus. So if they eat all that, the forests disappear. If the forests disappear, the young fish, hatchlings, actually normally live in that forest, and hatchlings from outside in the ocean, the Pacific, they suddenly begin to disappear. knock out the sea otters, and in fact the consequence is loss of fertility in the sea oceans of fish upon which we might wish to live. So it's an example of the complexity, and there are many much more complex relationships within the natural world than that one. So that a healthy natural world is absolutely essential for human society.
And like you say, that the chain is so delicate, isn't it? And that if you pluck out some of these gaps without realizing what you're doing, the consequences, the repercussions go for generations.
Yes.
Yeah. And talking of generations, people of my generation now are beginning to step into positions of leadership around the world. The work to save the planet is probably largely going to happen on our watch. What advice do you have for my generation, and what can we build on that you have started?
I think the paradox that there has never been more a time when more people have been out of touch with the natural world than is now. And we have to recognize that every breath of air we take, every mouthful of food that we take, comes from the natural world. And that if we damage the natural world, we damage ourselves. We are one coherent ecosystem. It's not just a question of beauty or interest or wonder. It's the essential ingredient, the central part of human life is a healthy planet. We are in the danger of wrecking that. If we don't recognize the sort of connections that I've been describing, then the whole of the planet becomes in hazard. And we are destroying the natural world, and with it, ourselves.
So, turning specifically to the people in this room, here in front of us, David, bear in mind they're all leaders in their particular field. What is your message, if you have a particular message, what is your message to them?
Care for the natural world. Not only care for the natural world, but treat it with a degree of respect and reverence. The natural world is, as I've said, the source of all wonder, and our future, we're bound up together. The future of the natural world is in our hands. We have never been more powerful. We can wreck it with ease. We can wreck it without even noticing that we're doing it. And if we wreck the natural world, in the end, we wreck ourselves. In our daily lives, I suppose the thing that I really care for, just in ordinary daily lives, is not to waste the riches of the natural world on which we depend. And it's not just energy, which of course is very important, but it's also dealing with the natural world with a degree of respect. Not to throw away food, not to throw away power, just care for the natural world of which we're an essential part.
And there's obviously a connection between environmentalism, capitalism, and economic success, isn't there?
Between?
Environmentalism, capitalism, and economic success.
Yes.
I think that's quite an interesting sort of topic that the audience here would find very interesting.
That's why this particular event and this particular day, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the most optimistic things I've seen for a very long time. This disaster, this creeping disaster, which has overtaken the world and is in the danger of really damaging it beyond repair, it started in Britain in the Industrial Revolution in the 18th century. And in developing nations, to the natural world at the stage, as it did in America, seemed to be, as it were, there to be conquered. A terrible word, to conquer the natural world. We have to get out there and show our mastery of it and destroy it in the process. And that had underlay the human reaction to the natural world for a very long time, and still is seen by some people that in fact humanity, and industrialized humanity in particular, is in opposition to the natural world. It is not. We are all one world, and that is the important thing that we have to recognize, and which organizations like this and events like this give you the optimism of feeling that that fact, that fundamental, beautiful fact, is now being recognized. That is why it is so exciting to be at this great, important occasion, where people attending it have more power, perhaps, than any other gathering in the world. And the feeling that those responsible for this gathering recognize this fundamental truth, and that people who come here will actually not only recognize it, but do something to make sure that that pact between the natural world and humanity is given its proper place and honor.
You used the word optimism there, David, quite a few times. Do you feel the narrative around climate change and environmentalism sometimes can be quite pessimistic, and that actually there is a real need for injection of optimism?
In a sense, I shrink from saying either an optimist or a pessimist. I mean, what good does it do to say you're pessimistic? That is not the point. The point is that we have this option ahead of us. We have to take the option of protecting the natural world. And we are discovering more ways in which we can do so. I am hearing all around, yes, we can do this, we can help that, and so on. The fact that we are now actually beginning to get power directly from the sun and the other renewables, and that we can see that there's no longer any need for us to pollute the world with the byproducts of our devices for generating energy, that we can do that, is becoming reality all over Europe, all over the world. And that's where the future lies. When one looks at the consequences of what we've done to the natural world in the processes of raising energy, we no longer need to. So there's a source of great optimism there. We have the power, we have the knowledge, actually, to live in harmony with nature.
And the world came together in the Paris Agreement to tackle climate change. But specifically in 2020, in Beijing, you and others were seeking a global deal for nature. Lots of people here probably haven't heard about that, David. Do you mind telling us why specifically that is so important?
Well, because Paris was a recognition by nations around the world that we have the natural world and humanity are interdependent. And Paris recognized what the dangers were, and they saw the problems about rising temperatures, about how climate, we have influenced the climate and caused appalling devastation with rising temperatures, and how it was paramount importance that we stop doing it, which we can do, we know how to do it, and a determination of the nations around the world that we should do it, and try and limit it, what we said, between two degrees and 1.5 degrees, average around the world. If we can do that, we can prevent loss of coral reefs, we can prevent all sorts of damages, we can reduce the extremes of weather that's overtaking the planet already, and that is essential for the future well-being of the planet. That was recognized by nations around the world, not universally, I have to say, and there have been people who have wished to withdraw from that. But nonetheless, the majority of the nations around the world have accepted that and recognized that and are working towards that. And that's where we must put our faith.
And David, you're specifically narrating a new landmark series called Our Planet. And you've worked with WWF, Silverback Films, and Netflix. Why did you decide to become involved in this particular project?
Because the issue has never been more important. And the issue that it should be recognized in not just one part of the world, not just in Europe, but worldwide. And the World Wildlife Fund gave us facilities to see the work that they've been doing, the researches they've been doing, the knowledge they've been doing about the way in which ecosystems are working and where there are dangers and where there are wonders, to enable us to produce this series of films. And by putting it on Netflix, it becomes possible overnight you can reach 150 million people immediately. I mean, I started television in the 1950s, and television in Britain at that time was only seen by a few million people in southern England. Now, with Netflix, it's possible to put on a transmission, and it is seen worldwide by hundreds of millions of people, and will go on being seen, available, when people, word of mouth, did you see that show? It's still there. It's still able for them to see it. So this is a way which the World Wildlife Fund recognized and gave us all the insights and the information, the practical help that we needed to make these programs. So the Worldwide Fund for Nature is worldwide, and this picture of the world will be coming worldwide simultaneously on one particular date and remain there.
And if I made you choose, David, which I'm going to do, would this be one of your most favorite projects or your most enjoyable in terms of actually what they've created, how they've filmed it, what's been shown, and bear in mind the time it's being shown in the world with the issues that are going on?
Yes, I mean, I started when it was just me and the cameraman and the clockwork camera. Yeah. You don't make natural history films like that anymore. The natural history films now of this sort of quality are made by literally hundreds of people. There may be 30, there may be 50 cameramen who'll be working on one particular program. I think something like 300 cameramen have worked on the series as a whole. Because now you've got the facilities to go up in the skies and the bottom of the seas. And you can trek over the polar wastes. You can go over the deserts. You can be in the jungles of the world. And all those pictures you can bring back in order to give a unique picture which human beings haven't seen until this generation.
Yeah. And I think you've chosen a favourite clip from Our Planet, which we're going to show in a second. Can you just tell us a bit about what we're going to see in the footage?
The footage of the glacier. Mm. One of the most immediate dangers that are facing the planet today is, of course, rising temperatures. Where you may see that, of course, is actually more up in the north than it is in the south. But in the Arctic is temperatures rising very, very fast. And the team who made this series determined, of course, that they would needed pictures of the melting ice that would symbolize this. And they went up to the north. Now the glaciers up in the north in the Arctic are moving very fast indeed. And they went to one particular glacier, knowing that it was advancing into the sea rather fast. Glaciers are always on the move a bit, but you need dramatic event.
They're a bit like children, David, unpredictable.
Yeah, quite so. But they wanted to see the glacier that was calving, that is to say, coming off in lumps. And they decided that the way they would see that best would be from the air and in a helicopter. They eventually, on the very last day of their location, they were up in a helicopter and they spied the glacier suddenly beginning to calve, that there were sections of the glacier the size of a skyscraper, of a great multi-storied building, falling into the water, causing huge surges. Now, you're a helicopter pilot. Is that tricky?
It can be, David, yes.
I mean, huge uprushes of air when the vast blocks fall into the sea. And what that does, and if you're a pilot, I mean, you will know how you're going to get a steady shot to see that. The pilot who was of the calving of the glacier, which is included in this series.
All helicopter pilots are very skillful, David. I think everyone will be fascinated to see the clip now. So if we could play the clip, that'd be fantastic.
Massive ice falls from the top of the glacier are just the beginnings of a far greater event. A stretch of the front face of the glacier, over a kilometre long, is starting to break away. 400 meters beneath the surface, the hidden ice is surging upwards. The size of a skyscraper generates a colossal tidal wave. Within 20 minutes, 75 million tons of ice break free.
Yeah.
In incredible footage, I think everyone would agree. David, it just remains me to say a huge thank you on behalf of everyone here for you being here today to talk so openly, and a huge congratulations again for winning the Crystal Award. A round of applause, please, for Sir David Attenborough.